My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Hagerts, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about immigration. Hi, Walter. Why are we speaking about this topic today? Why are we speaking about immigration in times when there's so many other things happening in the world?
Well, hi, Dario. If it were up to me, I would almost speak about immigration every day as a counterweight to the enormous avalanche of, if you like, lies that are being told about immigration in media and by politics day in, day out. I have been hypersensitive to the conversation of immigration for a long time now, for two reasons. First of all, morally, I am repulsed by the fact that we find it so difficult to let outsiders come into our countries and share the wealth that we have built up. But just as upsetting is the way that reality is misrepresented in the debate. How in media, in politics, broad numbers are thrown out there about supposed crisis of immigration, supposed problems with immigration, asylum seekers, refugees, without any actual attention to detail or reflection of what the real world looks like. And that's incredibly frustrating just from a analytical perspective. This specifically came up with us a couple of months ago, more than that, I would say maybe a year ago, when I pointed out that one thing that struck me as weird was that there was a mismatch between international numbers about the German population and the official Bureau of Statistics of Germany, and which was then copied also by some websites, Wikipedia and all that kind of thing. And I spoke to a statistician, and they said, yeah, the World Bank and the CIA Factbook use a completely different measure than the Germans, and apparently there's political pressure to keep the German population numbers inflated, to make it sound as if there are more people in Germany than there should be. And we talked about that at the time, and not long after that, it turned out that indeed German population figures had been inflated as part of this broad anti-immigration debate that exists within Germany.
Exactly. I very much remember this conversation because we had it over the course of a few months. Because it came up simply time and time again. And I was generally under the conviction that there were 84.5 million people living in Germany, which would be a significant growth kind of from the time that I grew up. It would have been like 5 million people in about 10 years. And then that correction came out and they said, aha, you know what, we kind of miscalculated, sorry. There's 1.4 million fewer people living in Germany than we originally thought, right? So the now number based on the census of 2022 is 82.7 million people living there. And that to me is, I don't know, it's scary, it's astonishing, because it's not only Wikipedia and a few websites, it's all of the media using those numbers, right? You have your typical news articles saying that, oh, now there's 84.5 million people living in Germany. And then the correction was actually a very minor detail on a lot of like news pages where just, you know, like all the way on the right side in a small little column, a few hundred words being spent on, oh, you know what, there's actually 1.4 million fewer people living in Germany. I was very shocked by that.
Yeah, and it was one of my proudest moments, Dario, that I could, before the world realized it, I could tell you there's a problem here. But it is a scary thing. It is scary how statistics get thrown about and are assumed to just automatically be true, especially if they fit the political narrative, and how that influences our perspective on things. Now, I should point out that regardless of whether you talk about 82 million or 84 million people, if you look at actually how big a deal that is compared to historical evolution, it shouldn't really matter. It's not a big deal either way, right? But the fact that it was apparently difficult for German statisticians to take down that number to the exact, to the real level of that we knew about is scary, and it says something about the world that we're living in and how we are misrepresenting reality and making really bad choices based on that misrepresentation.
before we kind of really dive into the topic of immigration, I think it's important that the two of us kind of almost put aside our personal general moral convictions when it comes to immigration, because I don't know, for me there's not a lot of convincing needed that we need immigration, right? Because of simply a demographic problem that most of the West faces, right? So there's that. But I also like to differentiate basically between migrants, so economic migrants who come to any country just for a better life, for better opportunities, whatever. And then there's refugees and asylum seekers, right? Refugees who are fleeing of war and asylum seekers who are fleeing from personal persecution from certain countries. And for me, I always hated that conversation about, oh, we want fewer refugees and migrants. Because that's not really, that's a wonderful wish you can have, but that is always a mismatch to reality, because there's war out there and there's people being persecuted. And then it's our, right, it's basically, we have to take them, and it shouldn't even be a moral discussion on, oh, do I really like this person's skin color, their religion? Are they really being persecuted? How bad is the war in Syria right now? Right? Because just now, where now Assad is gone from Syria, there's a huge conversation in Germany about, oh, now the Syrians can go, they can go back, right?
Yeah, and this is, so at the foundational level, and I have to be careful of that, because I might also try to be selective in the statistics that I'm looking at. It is incredibly painful to me that we live in a society where we don't feel that basic, if you like, moral framework, moral duty towards others, right? Where we say we live in an incredibly rich country and we do not want others to share in that wealth. To me, that is a morally reprehensible position to take, especially if you look at the reality of the wars that actually occur in the world, where our societies have a lot of impact and often responsibility for those wars. Those wars don't exist in a vacuum outside of our society. They are often encouraged or even started by our own society. So we have an automatic responsibility there. But even if we didn't, surely you see people suffering, you see people struggling, then that is a moment that say, hey, we will help you out. I personally go even a step further. And economic migration, I don't see any moral reason to say no. In fact, I think it is immoral to say no to a young 18-year-old or 20-year-old in a country that's economically less developed that says, I want to make something out of my life. I would like to come to Europe. What is wrong with that? Please let them come in. Now, there are certain limits. If all of a sudden 50 million people want to come in, you have to think carefully about, is this something that we can manage or not? There are managerial questions, but from a principled perspective, the idea of us saying we are rich, there are people in the world that are poor, and those poor people should, you know, not bother us because we want to maintain our wealth, to me is morally outrageous. However, those listeners that disagree with me saying that will not be convinced by my preaching. It is just a very personal moral conviction that I can get very, very angry personally about that position, that somehow our wealth is exclusive to us and outsiders are not entitled to it.
Which is why we said we will leave our preaching aside for this episode, because we need to basically move to the level of the conversation that people who are critical of migration basically have taken it, right? So we need to look at, okay, does this make sense, right? Are all migrants criminals, right? Do they take our jobs away, right? So those typical like arguments made usually by the far right, at least in the West, made by the far right. Let's look at them and let's talk about them even from a selfish perspective, right? From a very selfish perspective, do we need migration?
Well, and I think that is key here, right? So I've set my moral say, but now if you just ask me as an analyst, given the current situation in 2024, does Europe need more migration or less migration for Europe to thrive economically, culturally, etc.? The answer is, just based on statistics, based on reality, based on facts, a resounding yes. We need more migrants. We need more young people to come in, even older people, but certainly young people. Just from a perspective of how do we maintain the levels of well-being that we have in our society? Is there some kind of limits to how many people can come in 1 year? Of course, but that is a managerial question. But we need people to go to us, because otherwise Europe in the next 20, 30, 40 years is in deep, deep trouble.
Very deep trouble. Because, I mean, if we, right, it's always, I think with this topic, it's always good to kind of start with those population pyramids. Well, ideally pyramids, right? I mean, I've always learned them from the concept of pyramids. However, in the West, they should be really called something different, because it's everything but a pyramid, right? So usually you have the base is always young people. Then the further up you go with age, the fewer old people you have. And that's good for your society, because it means that the very strong, basically, youth can support the elders when it comes to retirement and so on. But in the West, that's not really the case, right? In some Western countries, it's even actually upside down, where there's very few young people who at some point have to support a lot of old retirees.
And I just saw, while researching this episode, I just saw statistic from the WHO that projected by 2050, the German population is projected to decrease by 7.5%. That is an enormous problem. If people think, oh, that's great because now we all have all more housing. No. It's terrible, because it is a lot of old people who are going to depend on very few young people. The economy will shrink. There will be all kinds of budgetary and other problems associated with that. This is bad, bad news if you're German. So, you know, there is no doubt, demographically speaking, that we are walking into a huge, huge problem. And the most obvious, clear, positive way to solve that problem is to have people from other parts of the world come into Germany, come into the European Union.
Because we have a good example of what it might look like if we don't do it, and that's Japan, right? I mean, we've talked about Japan, South Korea being part of the West. And when it comes to the population structure, Japan is the prime example, because Japan is also very critical towards immigration. And I remember 2 years ago, there was this big announcement for the first time, basically in a long time, Japan is seriously starting to rethink that model and say, okay, you know what, we have a lot of old people. None of them can work. Yes, automation basically could replace some jobs, but that's not really a sustainable model for anything here. What do we do? How do we do this?
And there's so much evidence historically that migrants, not just high birth rates, right? Because that's another way that you could solve it. If you could somehow make Germans have more babies, okay, then you could also... Now, that's not going to happen for lots of reasons. Beyond just a higher population growth, migrants coming into your society keep it dynamic. There is so much historical evidence of this. All the societies that did well in the past based on migration waves are examples of this. The Netherlands in the 17th century with the Huguenots from France and from Portugal coming in, being a huge stimulus to the Dutch economy. The 19th century and the early 20th century in the United States being a huge driver behind American economic growth and American prosperity. There are countless examples. And this is not just about population, that's part of it, but it's also about people from other cultures with other identities bringing in new ideas, making society more vibrant. It is fair to say that Japanese society has stagnated intellectually, culturally, in many ways. And that has a huge economic impact. Outsiders coming into your society and bringing a new voice is positive for your country. It's not some kind of, you know, great replacement theory that is happening in those situations. You know, that's the old right conspiracy theories about how white Germans are being replaced with people with another skin color. No. It is about people with new ideas fitting in and, yes, changing your society, bringing a new cultural dynamic to your society. But that is a good thing. That's not a bad thing. You can't stick to Lederhosen and whatever else the German people are up to forever. You need to, you know, understand that society changes over time.
That's not my people, please. Those are
Bavarians. Oh, that's Austrians.
I mean, it is the Germans, but it's the Bavarians. Those are very different for me. And if you look at the Oktoberfest, you would actually see that a lot of tourists from all over the world really enjoy the Lederhosen there. But that's the thing, right? One of the elements that we kind of spoke about is bringing in new ideas and new concepts. And I mean, again, both of us are... right? We're basically the elite, the globalist elite, right? That that really enjoys mixing these things. So I really hope that listeners who might be more critical of migration can like, well, can see that we're setting aside our preaching and we're now looking at the hard numbers. Kind of starting with this, Balder, how big of a problem is migration compared to other problems in our societies? Because if you look at kind of statistics, right now Germany is voting in a few months on what are the biggest issues. People are regularly saying that migration is one of the biggest issues.
Right. So we just had a little conversation about how much Germany actually spends on migration. And those numbers are not particularly clear because it depends what you count and what don't you count. For example, do you count the numbers that are being spent on keeping migrants out, which is a whole different kind of conversation than integrating migrants into your society. But I think it's fair to say that we came up with roughly 30 billion euros, right? That Germany spends in terms of social support, housing, those kinds of things for refugees, for asylum seekers, and other such groups. And now let's first look at just a basic fact. What does that mean? That sounds like a lot of money. That is in total less than 1% of GDP of the German economy a year. Now, because the German economy is 4.5 trillion or something like that, so it's less than 1%. It's, of course, a much bigger chunk of the German governmental budget. It's somewhere between 5 and 10%, depending on how you count it. But that is money that isn't just, so those 30 billion don't just disappear, right? They don't just go into the pocket of an average Syrian refugee who then sends it to Syria and it's gone. It is money that's being pumped into the German economy. It is not it's not money that Germans will never see again. It's German citizens, people with a German nationality. It goes to the landlords who house the refugees or the asylum seekers. It goes to the supermarkets where the asylum seekers or refugees buy goods. It goes to all kinds. It goes to the wages of people helping to integrate migrants. It is not 30 billion lost, and even if it were 30 billion lost, it's less than 1% of the total economy. Now, if you then compare that to the big questions, the big challenges facing Germany about competitiveness of exports, the car industry, how do you support the car industry, the environment, the big questions that can really make or break Germany in the next 20, 30 years, then it's nothing. And yet it covers all those newspaper pages, all those news reports on TV, on the internet, over and over again, as if it is the one thing that threatens Germany, which is just factually not correct if you look at this number.
Mm. It's, so to look at these 30 billion in more detail, right, so kind of 11.8 of them are in 2023, were spent on social payments, right, so that's just for them to kind of have basic housing, right, and have the most basic necessities to survive. 9.8 of them actually do not go to the German economy because they're being spent on combating the causes of flight, right? Because the Germans say, oh, we don't want more migrants. I would actually count that money towards development money, right? And Germany has always pledged that, hey, 1% of our budget, of our GDP, we want to spend on basically development money. So that's
sorry to interrupt, Dario, but that would then also kind of count as an anti-migration policy, right? So that's the thing. So that is not helping migrants; it's keeping migrants out.
Then there's kind of money being sent to the states and the cities who kind of deal with them on a managerial right level. Then for integration services, only 3 billion, which that's the number that I always like to see go up. And then the last one is kind of 1.2 billion on kind of all the managerial aspects from a federal level. And something you mentioned just before was actually a huge debate, at least in Germany a few months ago, was refugees and asylum seekers, and I'm specifically not saying migrants here, like economic migrants, right? Sending money home. So they receive money from the government and they send it home. And it was a huge discussion. And then this month, a study came out saying that only 7% of them actually send money home, which, that one you can also account for as combating causes of flight, because that means the rest of the family is not going to come over. As opposed to then, of course, the migrants who are here for economic reasons, right, who are working here, they are, of course, sending a lot of money home. But that's a completely different story because that's the money they've earned themselves and that's not from the government. So don't be upset about it.
Of course. And then if you look at it from a problem perspective, well, let's have a look at how many German tourists spend money abroad every summer when they go on holidays. And that is also money lost for the German economy. Then you could say, yeah, but Germans are allowed to do that. Sure, but we're talking about whether all of this is a problem or not, whether it's actually bad for Germany or not. I would argue that spending money abroad in New York and in Tokyo and in Australia is much worse for the German economy than those few Syrian refugees who send some money back to their families.
That's a very good argument. We should start a campaign for Germans only making vacation, having their vacations in Germany, only looking at, I don't know, Bavarian mountains and the Baltic Sea.
There you go. You know, obviously, my argument's not that there's anything wrong with Germans doing that. It is simply a matter of, is this a problem? Is this hurting significantly the German future, German society? And the answer to that is obviously no. Now, this whole conversation so far is about purely the cost, but that is not taking into account the benefits of those migrants into our society yet.
Absolutely. I mean, right, again, now I would like to differentiate between migrants, like the different types of migrants, right? Because I don't think we even need to have a conversation about the people who come to this country, to any country, to work or to study, right? Because they usually bring money in, they create more. But then there's always the kind of point of, okay, right, again, taking apart the preaching, there's people who come to a country because they're being persecuted and others, how dare they? Now we need to spend money on them. That's of course, terrible, right? Because why would they have their basic needs met? And why would we spend 3 billion a year on integrating them? That money we are never seeing again because, I don't know, I never know how the argument ends because I feel like that's not barely an argument.
Yeah. Now, so even those groups that don't directly come here to contribute to the economy, so part of their lack of contribution to the economy is because of the rules we set for them, right? Because they're not allowed to work. That is part because we somehow believe that if they work, they take away the jobs of German citizens and that kind of thing. So part of that is our own choice to not make them contribute to the economy. But even let's say that it's that they're here for 5 years, they're just living off German social welfare, and then they go home once the conflict is done. Those people, they still will contribute in terms of their connections with their home country, in terms of the future, in terms of the way that Germany is perceived. And if you treat them badly, you don't give them any support, they go home and they will never ever want to think about Germany again. It could also be seen as an investment into the relationship that Germany has with the rest of the world. Relatively productive investment, because they will speak a bit of German maybe when they go home, they will want to do business with Germany, it will help German exports, it will help the German reputation if done correctly. If done badly, then it becomes a waste, because then people will just hate Germany for the rest of their lives and they will never want anything to do with Germany ever again, obviously.
And even in the few years where they receive, like, they receive these benefits, right? As you already said, they're spending them in Germany. I mean, that's what it doesn't necessarily hurt, because they're spending it in German supermarkets. The landowners or the house owners are receiving rent. So basically it's another form of stimulus, right? And I mean, I do think that the number of people leaving, depending on the conflict, right, is not that high. I mean, for refugees, it's different, right? Because their legal status, it kind of obliges them that as soon as the conflict is over, refugees have to leave again. Right. So that's, for example, the category that the Ukrainians fall under that, have come to Germany during kind of the height and the worst, parts of the Russian invasion. A lot of them have already gone back. Some of them are still here. But when it comes to asylum seekers, there's a chance that they're actually staying in the country, And then at some point they will have learned the language, hopefully. They will have received a better education, hopefully. And then they're allowed to work, hopefully. Again, I'm kind of saying these things because that has not always been the case, in particularly Germany, where it wasn't always kind of the government's policy to try to integrate people as well as possible.
And then they become part of that broader migration conversation, which is just like, hey, you know what? Over and over again, study after study, and any Google search will show this. If people are doubting, I mean, well, maybe we can put a whole list at the bottom of our episode, but I don't think it's necessary. You can just Google this yourself. There are countless studies, absolute scientific consensus that immigrants into your country, economic immigrants or asylum seekers or refugees who then stay, broadly speaking, are good for the economy. They actually stimulate the economy over the long term. It actually, they bring more value to the economy than they take out of it. It's completely economically obvious. And so what you want to do as a society is say, okay, asylum seekers, what are you going to do? Are you going to just be, do you just want to be here for a couple of years and then go back home? In that case, then our relationship is going to be slightly different. We're not going to worry too much about the long term, but we're going to have you have a house because we're human beings and we want you to stay safe. Or is there a chance that you're going to stay in the long term? In which case, we're going to prepare you for that. And that's going to be good for you and it's going to be good for us. That is the way you deal with this from a rational, analytical perspective if you care about the well-being of Germany.
Absolutely. And I mean, so let's maybe move away from Germany for a second to kind of back this up with it from maybe another country, because in the research for this episode and with this chance, thank you very much to our researchers kind of for supporting us with this. We focused on three countries, kind of the three more prominent countries in the West, on the United States, the United Kingdom and Germany. And the United States, they have very nice data on this, that basically the share of 2023 entrepreneurs who are immigrants in the United States was 17.4%. And even more interestingly, right, because you spoke about the long term, the second generation immigrants, the share of entrepreneurs was 19%. Because, of course, maybe the first generation of immigrants, of let's say asylum seekers or refugees, they have it difficult because they didn't grow up in the country. The German, let's use the example of Syria and Germany. The German culture is very different from the Syrian culture. Of course, it's going to be very difficult for you to integrate, right? The language is not easy to learn. Mannerisms, education is on a different level. Yeah, it's a tough piece of work for both sides. No one is denying that. But for their children who were born in Germany, went to a German school and so on, that's a different deal. And that's something that we're clearly seeing in the United States with basically a third of all entrepreneurs being migrants or second generation migrants.
And in there, the conversation can be very productive and very interesting about how do you organize this? How do you manage this? There you can have a very serious conversation about what is the way to make sure that people coming into your country actually play as quickly as possible, either the people themselves or the next generation play a productive part. Now, again, if you have a society which is sort of Trump at the moment in the United States, the sort of Republican conservative approach to this, which kind of despises immigrants, that creates a negative environment, it's going to be much harder for those people to integrate and play a positive role in society. If you take the approach that the United States took 100 years ago, the Statue of Liberty, bring your masses to us, then they will integrate much faster, much quicker, much better. You want to make sure that there are not going to be ghettos of migrants that just feel alienated from the society around you. You want them to have the right papers, to go to good schools, to be able to learn the language quickly. Those kinds of conversations about how do we manage productive, constructive immigration are really valuable. And you can do it badly and you can do it well. And we can learn from mistakes in the past and we can look at how to improve the future. But that needs to be based on the question not of how do we keep migrants out, but how do we make sure that as quickly as possible they contribute to the well-being of our society.
Mm-hmm. We have now talked a lot about migrants contributing to the well-being of society. There's also a lot of voices out there that say that migrants are doing the opposite. They're committing crimes. You know, at ridiculous rates.
Yeah. So this is interesting because in the United States, there are very clear figures and numbers that show that this is simply not true, that your average migrants who arrive to the United States during their lifetime and are not necessarily American citizens yet are less likely to commit crimes than your average American citizen. Does that mean that immigrants don't ever commit crimes? No, of course not. Immigrants do commit crimes. And what you will see is those that are alienated from society are more likely to commit crimes than those who are not alienated from society. But I can say this as from my own personal experience, right? I am an immigrant in Spain. I'm an economic migrant. I come from the Netherlands and I now live in Spain. To be honest, I don't live here because of a job, but, you know, because my work was secondary to me just really wanting to live in Spain. So that makes me worse in some way. I would be much more worried about getting, you know, being confronted by Spanish police than I would be in the Netherlands, because I feel a little bit that I have to be a bit careful. I don't feel as comfortable with Spanish procedures, Spanish institutions, and so it is more intimidating to me. So if I were ever tempted in any way to break the law, that would much more likely happen in the Netherlands for me than in Spain, because I'm an immigrant, I know that I'm an outsider, and I have to fit into this society. That is typically how immigrants behave in society.
The moment I talk to the German police, I turn into a Karen. There's nothing they can do to me. I know my rights, right? That difficult sentence. I mean, that feeling we can also pack up with data, right? As in the United States, immigrants are 60% less likely to be incarcerated than native citizens. Right. That's, I mean, of course, it's because exactly of what you said is I don't, like, if I'm a guest in your house, I'm going to be a tad more respectful than if I'm a guest in my own house.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, and that is not just a conscious choice. It's also a subconscious thing. You walk around in a society that isn't completely your own yet. Maybe in the future it will be, but it doesn't feel quite as your own yet. You don't quite know what to expect if something goes wrong. So you want to avoid things going wrong. You want to keep your head down and you want to be a good, productive, respected citizen. You want the society around you to like you. You want to conform to that society as long as you feel that you can integrate. The moment that you are an outsider and you just live in a, you know, like I said, in a ghetto where nobody cares about you, that becomes then a different story. And that's where, again, that managerial organizational question comes in.
We've now talked, for a very good reason, we've talked more about asylum seekers and refugees coming, right? Because those are usually kind of also the images that we see in the media. So in the United Kingdom, this would be people arriving on boats in masses, right? Like the Romans were invading the island back then. Or you always kind of see these images from the US border wall to Mexico, of people climbing over ladders and trying to get into the United States. But that's, right, I mean, that's not really the part of migrants that are necessarily the big numbers. Those are usually the lower numbers. One of the things, right, so for us, the UK case was very interesting, particularly because it's such a big topic in UK politics, right? The boat migrants on small boats crossing the English Channel. Let's put some perspective into this with numbers. So in 2024, 30,000 people have crossed the English Channel in small boats to the UK, right? Basically, most of them were there to kind of apply for asylum, but that was only a quarter of all UK asylum applications, which are roughly at more or less 100,000 people in that year. However, asylum applications only make up about I think it was 12. Make up about 6% of immigrants in the United Kingdom. That's very few.
Yeah, that's very few. And then of those roughly 100,000 that make up the 6%, then you some people can apply twice in different according to different routes. So the numbers of people actually applying is a bit smaller than that. And then on top of that, a lot of those applications will also be rejected. So then when you look at the actual percentage of asylum seekers that make up the inflow of people into your country, the actual factual immigration into your country, then you're talking about really, really small numbers. Now compare that to the political and media coverage of the boats, of how many problems apparently these boats cause. Then there is a complete disconnect between political and media narrative on the one hand and just factual reality, the statistics you just mentioned, on the other hand. Now, I find it fascinating for a lot of reasons because it kind of fits so beautifully into Britain as an island nation and just feeling threatened by boats. You know, the Royal Navy needs to protect us from the evil foreigner. You know, it fits into this whole imperial Brexit kind of attitude towards the world. But just the reality shows that the people coming in by boats are not a big deal for the UK, and yet everyone talks about them all the time and is even willing to change the law. Keir Starmer wanted to introduce terrorism measures against these boat immigrants. Pure political grandstanding. It's got nothing to do with the reality that we see in front of us, but they are apparently willing to basically forgo basic constitutional, in the UK constitutional is always weird, but basic legal principles in order to fight this imaginary monster that comes across the channel.
I quickly have to correct myself. It was 11% of immigrants to the UK were asylum seekers, right? But as you said, about 33% of them were basically initially like or immediately refused. The refusal rate is kind of steadily going up in the United Kingdom.
And then you have to look at the net asylum seekers, because a number of every year asylum seekers also go back home again, because they're either told to go home by the UK authorities or they choose to go home because their countries are more peaceful, less threatening, etc.
Yeah. And then the people who actually come, right, because we're talking about, it really depends on the year, but we're kind of roughly talking about somewhere between 900,000 to a million, a bit above that, people who come to the UK every year. Of course, there's a lot of people leaving, right? Because otherwise, the population would indeed be growing very, very fast. But the type of people who are coming are less so from the European Union. There's some political reasons for that that I haven't really figured out yet in the last few years. I think Brexit had something to do with it. But a lot of it are Indian and Pakistani, right? For historical reasons. I mean, there's a similar language, right? There is a similar language. It's English. And then you also have, right, the colonial past. People from Bangladesh are there, from South Africa, Nigeria, right? The United Kingdom is also a more attractive kind of migration destination because of the language. I mean, I don't know if you ask me as, let's say I were a small boy in Nigeria, turning 18 soon, thinking, okay, there's not really any jobs here, let me go somewhere. If I had to choose between Germany and the United Kingdom, I think my choice would be really easy, because for language reasons, for cultural reasons, it might be easier to go to the United Kingdom.
Well, I think the cultural aspect is also very important here, right? You're right about language, but also these people typically feel less intimidated by British culture because they're already aware of it, they already know it, than German culture. Because what do they know about Germany? Germany is a weird country that they've never really been in touch with. Whereas there's a lot of, in the Anglophone world, there's a lot of familiarity with how the UK works, how England works, how London works. This is all a very positive kind of thing if you're British, to have people who feel comfortable with your society go in and say, I want to be part of your society, I want to make a success out of myself. And there is no real reason to stop that. Now, those groups that you just mentioned are a much bigger percentage than those few people coming across the channel by boat. And yet the conversation is all about the boats. And that should, you know, make us all angry, because we need to have a practical conversation about reality, not about some fictitious threat that doesn't actually exist.
But it's so much easier to talk about them, right? Because, I mean, hey, people arriving by boats to the UK, that's an easy picture on the front of a newspaper, right? It's, people are coming via boat. They're not taking their time to go through the due process. How dare they, basically, right? Or try to arrive in our country by force. Then you have, once in a while an incident where, I don't know, like a certain crime will kind of spark public interest. And if that is then done by an immigrant, that's another great political opportunity for right-wing parties to score points, right? So you can kind of combine these images of people are coming on boats and there was a stabbing. Well, all these stabbers coming on boats, so we are against immigration. Completely misrepresenting the actual nature of who is coming and how they're coming, and then what they're doing in your country at that time, and how much they're actually helping you, kind of continuing your lifestyle.
In high school, in the early 90s, before I went to study in the UK, I actually wrote an essay. It must have been for, I don't know, sociology, philosophy. I can't remember what it was for. I wrote an essay pointing out how in the Netherlands, in Dutch media, crimes are reported. And 9 out of 10 times, the crime is just reported as, hey, someone has been murdered or things are stolen. 1 out of 10 times, it is detailed what the background of that person is, of the criminal is. And when the background of the criminal is detailed, it is because they have a migration background. They are either Moroccan or Turkish. So 9 out of 10 times, it is just a white citizen who has been there whose ancestors have been in the Netherlands for hundreds of years. It doesn't get highlighted. It only gets highlighted when it is an immigrant who does it, which creates a very false perspective on crime, right? Because our brain registers, oh, this was someone from the outside, so the outsider is a threat. And we don't register it when it was just a German or Dutch or Spanish person who committed it, because the media don't emphasize that.
I mean, it happens in Germany all the time, right? Every time there is kind of a breaking news item that, I don't know, there was a stabbing somewhere, or maybe even a shooting where more than one or two people died, and it's a dynamic situation, certain parts of the political spectrum jump onto social media and basically post, yet another one of Merkel's friends, right? Kind of pointing at the refugees that have come into Germany since 2015, is killing an innocent German, right? And then, right? I mean, sometimes that's the case, but enough times that's not the case, and it's a German doing that, and then suddenly, very quickly, they have to delete their tweets, and then it's silent, and then the public outcry is way different than the other way around. That's one of those things that I was actually quite hesitant about recording this episode and talking about all those anti-migration narratives, because kind of working in public affairs, I have learned that one of the worst things you can do is kind of repeating and reproducing those negative narratives, right? Because as soon as you kind of talk about it and you portray the idea that, oh, there's a refugee crisis, there's a migration wave, there's a caravan heading to our border, right, that if you kind of talk about these things and you maybe accidentally, subconsciously copy the language, you kind of support their narrative, actually. And I mean, we've seen how the overall narrative within the West has shifted a lot to the right in the past 10, 20 years, particularly in the last 10 years.
Now, and this exactly happened, I don't know if you recall, in Britain during the summer, when there were girls were stabbed in a knife attack in Southport, and it led to enormous riots by the radical right against immigration, assuming that it was done by some kind of asylum seeker. There had been some kind of rumor about, which turned to be completely false. The moment it turned out to be false, the damage had been done. There was this enormous narrative about how asylum seekers are murdering girls with knives, right? It's those narratives that are pushed out there. The same if you see an overflowing asylum center, that you think, oh, there's a crisis because, look, there's a building and we've got room for 200 asylum seekers. And now it turns out that there are 500 asylum seekers out there. Our brain goes, oh, there's a crisis. Instead of our brain going, oh, why have we underfunded the asylum process for the past 10 years? And how is it possible that we don't have 500 beds? Why do we only have 200 beds, right?
Yeah, that was the big difference in Germany between 2015 with 1 million Syrians coming and 2022 and 1 million Ukrainians coming. Is in 2015, the system was simply not set out for large numbers of, like, tens of thousands of people arriving almost every day. Because that then back then that was the case, right? You had basically trains and people walking, kind of like walking all the way from Syria to Germany, and there were tens of thousands of people arriving, and you had gyms filled and so on and so forth, right? And then it took some months, and after a few months, kind of that big. See, I'm trying everything right now not to use the word wave, but that big increase. In numbers, right? You kind of like that. Once that settled down, then people actually got in. Everyone was taken care of. And then if you compare this to 2022, the system was already there, right? It was very easy to scale that up. Oh, 1 million Ukrainians are coming because there's war in Russia. Okay, let's get those numbers going. We know what this is not a drill. We've done that in the past, right? And suddenly it worked a lot smoother, a lot easier. A lot of these processes, and that's basically this thing, right? Of how much money do you actually invest into migration? Do you spend money on, I don't know, increasing border controls, or do you spend money on internal managerial structures?
Well, and the answer at the moment in Europe is typically let's spend less because we want to keep immigrants out, which is exactly the wrong answer to the practical problem that we're facing, right? The Netherlands, for example, has these overflowing asylum centers, not because there is a huge crisis of asylum seekers coming into the country, but simply because we've been starving the beast for a very long time. And now the Dutch government has already announced that they're going to spend even less on asylum centers. So you're going to see more overflowing asylum seekers. People see that on the news, and they will be reinforced in their idea that there's a huge crisis. Well, there is a crisis. It's called a managerial crisis. Not because there are millions and millions of people coming into the Netherlands, but because the government is not managing it well, is not organizing it well.
Mm. And that, then, I can tell you what this leads to, because that's that experiment Germany has run for the past decades, where right after World War II, for some reason, a lot of German men were dead. They were, I assume, out fighting a war and dying in one of the more senseless actions of the human population. So when it came to rebuilding Germany, the Germans realized, oh, we don't have enough people. What do? Okay, let's call our friends from all countries, telling them, hey, we're friends now. And we would like to invite you as guest workers for 10 years, more or less, right? It would be great if you could come. You could help us rebuild the country. You make a lot of money and then you leave again. Okay, a lot of people took on that deal and said, oh, that sounds like a lovely deal. Let's see whether we can rebuild Germany. And then after those 10 years, they kind of realized, you know what? I've now been living in Germany for 10 years. I live a very good life. I live in a very nice house. I have a very nice salary. I think I would like to have my family actually here. You know, my wife, I've been sending her money for all these months. So let me bring my wife over and my family. Which, that's a great difference, right? Because these guest workers, like the men, typically men, were very well integrated. But no one in the German politics expected for them to stay and for them to kind of bring over their families. So nothing was done on the immigration side of things, right? On the like integration side of immigrants, where then they said, okay, yeah, you can have your women here, but you know, we'll all put you into the same parts of towns, kind of creating little ghettos. We don't really want to see you creating like this invisible group within the population. And now people are surprised that the second and third generation of these immigrants, right, their children and grandchildren, that they are not very well integrated. Well, how? If you didn't allow the mothers to kind of learn German or give them courses on basic things, and now you have a huge group of kids who feel disenfranchised from society, who don't really feel like they fit in. That's the result of not spending any money on integration.
And creating, if you like, a hostile environment, right? I'm here quoting the words of Theresa May, who as Home Secretary and as Prime Minister very much wanted, in her own words, to create a hostile environment for people coming into the country. The moment you create a hostile environment for people living in your country, whether it's first generation or second generation or third generation, it's going to be much harder for them to be productive members of that society. Obviously, this is not rocket science. This is not something that's difficult to understand. Now, having said that, you see that a lot of these people overcome these obstacles thrown at them. There's also always obstacles of racism, of Islamophobia, and all of those kinds of things. Overcome those obstacles and actually become really, really productive, and even more productive than your average sort of white, blonde German members of society. And that should tell us that if we made it a little bit easier for them, if we lowered those obstacles to those young people, everyone would benefit. Instead, because of right-wing populism, we're going in the other direction.
Do you know what we call them here in Germany?
I have no idea.
My friends. Right, because I mean, I obviously, right, I went to school, surprise, surprise, and I live in Germany, and there have been, right, different migration patterns and movements from all over the place, right, and then there is my friend from, like, her parents migrated here from Albania, and she just a few weeks ago became a doctor officially, right, and then you have my friend whose parents migrated here from Turkey, and he's a policeman, right, and you can kind of, there's engineers and so on, and you can kind of continue this, and yeah, of course, if you don't try to disenfranchise kind of the youth as much as possible, and their parents, and you actually take them in and you teach them and so on, what reason would there be for them not to become productive members of society, right? That's exactly, I don't know, I'm falling into the preaching type of stuff again, but it's, for me, it's really difficult to understand why some people refuse to see this.
Yeah, and it's very clear. I also have one anecdotal example here. So I've got a friend, if you like to use that word. I mean, we know each other reasonably well, from the DRC, from the Democratic Republic of Congo, who lives in Madrid, and who is way more successful. He's a scientist. He works at a international firm, does research in physics. And he is way more successful in many ways than I am, has got a very good salary, speaks Spanish perfectly, much better than my Spanish. I have never encountered a Spanish person somehow talking badly towards me because I'm an outsider, because I'm a foreigner, even though I'm very clearly a foreigner. I look foreign, I don't speak native Spanish, all that. He speaks perfect Spanish. He encounters racism and xenophobia all the time. That makes it much harder for him to actually integrate in society. And it's got nothing to do with his professional success or his willingness to integrate. It's just that it is much harder for these people because of this overall approach by society.
Mm. Let's say there are some negative consequences or some negative outcomes of migration. How should we deal with this? I mean, because, again, there are these examples, right, of kind of certain effects and individual cases not being amazing.
Yeah, so, of course, there are negative effects. In the sense, there are negative effects from any human being in society, right? You can look at any group or any individual in any society, and there are some negative results for the rest of us, whether it is us playing loud music or actually committing a crime or polluting or being aggressive or anything like that. So what the answer is, think carefully about what we want with migration, what we want with immigrants, how they contribute to our society, and how we can stimulate that positive contribution, and then deal with the negative consequences, either economic costs or other kinds of negative externalities, in the same way we would deal with externalities from a German citizen, from a Spanish citizen, from a Dutch citizen, right? Look at how we can mitigate those damages, how we can mitigate the negatives, but don't do it from a perspective of, oh, if an immigrant or an asylum seeker causes some problem, that is a sign that we don't want asylum seekers. But if it's a Spanish person, well, of course, well, whatever. It's part of being human. It's the human condition. It's not making that distinction when it comes to the negative outcomes of human beings, right? Don't distinguish between outsiders and insiders in that regard.
And if we do the overall cost-benefit analysis, we come out in the net positive. Like, yes, there will be, right, in the short term, either real negative effects or perceived negative effects, right? Oh, we're spending so much money on immigrants, right? 10% of the budget. But if you then do the actual cost-benefit analysis, that's a really good deal you're getting.
Yeah, That's exactly the point. And it's not just voluntary, I would argue, right? It is an absolute need for our society. It's not just that it's good for us to have immigrants or asylum seekers or refugees for moral reasons, but certainly also for economic reasons, come into our countries. That is not just a thing like, hey, it would be nice if. If we don't let much greater numbers of people come into our countries and settle and become productive parts of our society, 20, 30, 40 years down the line, the next generation is going to pay an enormously heavy price. That is a conversation that we need to have. It is very clear from the statistics. It is very obvious that it is a need, otherwise we're going to decline into a very dark place. It seems completely counterintuitive to me that the current political conversation is having a conversation about how we can limit the inflow of people. It should be the opposite.
We said that we want to end this conversation on a more positive note, right? Because honestly, talking about like all these purposely wrongful, like or wrong narratives kind of sickens me a little bit. So we decided to include two more positive stories at the end of this episode. And one of them actually just happened last week, right? So again, for transparency, we're recording this on the 14th of December, 2024. And last week, Sunday, I was traveling here in Germany, and that was also the day when it was clear that Bashar al-Assad, right, the long-term dictator and really terrible human being in Syria, basically fled Syria himself to Moscow or somewhere to Russia. And it was a great day in Germany, not because of what might happen in Syria now, right? We don't know, nobody knows. But obviously, tens of thousands of people streamed to the streets, Syrians, kind of to the big marketplaces, right? I mean, hey, they've integrated very well. So they basically said, we will have a demonstration that day. And right, they followed proper etiquette, which me as a German, you know, made me very proud. But it kind of made me, or like, it kind of reminded me one more time, right, who came 9 years ago, right? Or 8 or 9 years ago. And it was a lot of parents, right? A lot of parents with very young children all celebrating that now their home country is free. And you kind of looked around and you see people happy, right? Celebrating, there's music, there's crying out of happiness and so on and so forth. And in the middle of that is are a lot of children, right? And they were born in Germany. And right, so that was one of those moments just where I kind of realized again, it's if you kind of put like a real face to all of these conversations, to all of these numbers, and if you look at the individual kind of story behind all of them, and you see that, I don't know how you can kind of be negative about this. And right, that's we have a lot more research, right? I think we could record another 3-4 hours on this topic, but there's so many small positive stories, right? Where I don't know, in rural Germany, they were in small towns, there were schools that were about to be closed down a few years ago because there weren't enough children. Well, in 2016, then let's say two families moved there, and there's really countless stories of that with children, and the children went to school. And now that school stayed, right? So there's so many little positive stories coming out of all of this that obviously outweighs all the, I don't know, individual negative stories that you might hear about in the media. And so that's my little positive story that I wanted to share with you, and obviously also with the rest of our listeners, because it's very heartwarming.
Well, and some people might say, hey, Dario, that is just an anecdote. But this is exactly the point, right? You can look at the hard statistics, and then it's quite clear. It's quite obvious that net immigration is good for our countries. But the whole political and media conversation is about negative anecdotes as well, right? So you give here a positive anecdote, and we can have a whole list, hundreds of positive anecdotes about the diversity that it brings, the great ideas that it brings, new entrepreneurs, new everything that would indicate a positive impact. The problem is that the political debate and the image in people's brains comes from negative anecdotes of an overflowing asylum center, of a refugee committing a crime, of a number that is 10 billion being spent on social support, which is meaningless if you don't look at the bigger picture. So it is a good thing to have those anecdotes that are positive in nature, to counterbalance the negative anecdotes, knowing that overall the story is one of net benefit for our society.
And there seems to be a country in the West that understood this, or at least a government, and that's the, oh my God, my Spanish friends are going to kill me now, but that's the Sanchez government.
Yeah, no, I myself have some problems with Sanchez government, but this is absolutely a good thing. And I love the fact that it's kind of a FU to Northern European governments who are having the opposite conversation, right? So the Spanish government has announced that they're gonna integrate almost a million, over 3 years, 300,000 people a year annually into society that already had a residence permit before, but lost that for because it ran out, and they're now gonna be offered permanent residency. That is such a positive move. It is something that Spain needs. It's something that Spain can also do because economically it's going quite well. So politically, it's harder to argue against it, even though even if the economy does badly, it should be part of the conversation. In fact, it should be even more in demand if the economy does badly. But so it is a sign of the Spanish government understanding that this is good for Spanish society. That is something that actually will benefit Spain in the long run. Now notice how it is people who already previously had a residence permit. So it is not unbridled immigration. It's not the Spanish government saying, hey, anyone who now wants to come in and fly into Spain, you're gonna get a residence, you're gonna get our nationality. No, 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 it is managed, it is well thought out, and it makes so much sense. And for the sake of Dutch and German and British citizens, I hope those governments are paying attention to Spain and are thinking, hey, actually, this is actually going to give Spain an advantage over us. And maybe we should start thinking in a similar way.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on immigration. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. And we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote do you pick for us today?
I mentioned at the beginning of this episode how historically wave after wave of immigration into countries were a sign of prospering times, actually made society stronger, added to the cultural and intellectual wealth of societies, added to the economics. And I mentioned the Netherlands in the 17th century as an example of a relatively liberal country where persecuted minorities, Jewish or Christian persecuted minorities, could flee to. And one really nice anecdotal example of this is, of course, Spinoza, a Portuguese philosopher, but who added mostly to Amsterdam and Dutch intellectual progress because he and his family lived in the Netherlands during most of his productive years. And therefore, I thought I'll take a quote from him. He said, "I have striven not to laugh at human actions, not to weep at them, nor to hate at them, but to understand them.